Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is a discussion about the Buñuel in Mexico series at MoMA. I've been very excited to attend a few screenings already. It's such an interesting period of his career. I think people are more familiar with what came before and what came after, with the possible exception of Los Olvidados, which I think is also, you know, just as famous as those other parts of his career. Very glad to have Dave Kerr, a curator in the Department of Film at MoMA, to talk about it.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
I wonder if we could just start with a little bit about this portion of his career. How did he end up starting making films in Mexico, and what was the kind of outline of that there?
Well, it's a kind of a long and interesting story, and it involves Museum of Modern Art, actually.
Yeah.
When he was kind of without work in the 1930s and more or less a refugee from what was going on in Europe, Iris Berry, who was the first director of the film department at MoMA, hired him as a technician. He was in charge of producing prints for a program that Nelson Rockefeller had founded to send like a pro-American propaganda to Latin America. This is part of the Good Neighbor policy. There was a concern that Latin America was going to go to the other side, so they were trying to make sure that wasn't going to happen. So his responsibility here was to oversee the creation of these prints and such like. At some point, MoMA also had a contract with the War Department to collect all the German propaganda films that were being taken in Europe. So all of that stuff came in through MoMA and got sorted out. Buñuel was sort of around for that, although he was never part of that project. And in his autobiography, he kind of wildly exaggerates and says that he was, and that he, in fact, re-edited Triumph of the Will in, you know, high surrealist fashion. And to this day, I mean, we start getting calls from people, why are you suppressing this masterpiece? Why can't we see it? And believe me, if it existed, we'd be showing it all the time, but it just doesn't. It's something he kind of made up.
Wow.
One of the many entertaining anecdotes in a very entertaining book should not be taken literally.
I've been reading it. I guess I fell for it because I was like, oh man, I have to track this down now, this special Buñuel cut.
It sounds so great. There is a shortened version of Triumph of the Will in the collection that looks like it's just like a digest, two or three of the longer sequences cut together, but there's nothing interesting, nothing creative about it. At some point, Salvador Dali shows up in New York with his new autobiography and is trying to make a splash for himself, and he's running around telling people that Louis Buñuel is a communist. And this is, you know, 1947, not a real great time to be a communist.
No.
Even if Buñuel was, it seemed like he was a fellow traveler. There's a funny story that Nelson Rockefeller asked him what his politics were. He said, I'm a Republican, meaning the Spanish Republic,
right.
Not Nelson's Republican. Whether that's true or not, I hope it is. So Buñuel, rather than bring more pressure down on Iris Berry in the film department, decided it was time to move on. And he eventually found this producer, Oscar Danziger, who was also exiled and taken up a position in Mexico and was able to start making films there. Buñuel, at this point, you know, he's not a famous director. He's famous for, you know, the two scandalous films of the late 20s, early 30s, Chien de Loup and L'Âge d'Or. L'Âge d'Or could not be shown anywhere publicly during this whole period. Just incredible. What a scandal that film was. We forget.
Yeah.
But he's able to get into a sort of commercial filmmaking in Mexico. And the first project he works on takes advantage of a Nelson Rockefeller program to supply low-cost film footage to the Latin American country. So it kind of comes full circle.
Ah, I see.
The general impression has been for years that he just kind of took this job to support his family, put food on the table, waiting for something else to come along. But I don't think the films bear that out. He immediately plunges right in. He's very much involved with the history of the Mexican cinema. He understands who the stars are. He starts exploring all the different genres and his genre musical, which is, you know, very, very Mexican. And throughout his rather lengthy career, he's there for 12 years. He develops from being a gifted independent experimental filmmaker into something he's just incredibly fluent in the language of film. Mm-hmm. I mean, between him and Hawks and Ford, it's like just the absolute mastery. Camera always in the right place. This very unique way of just, instead of cross-cutting during dialogue scenes, he repositions the camera to keep things sort of circulating, and a sense of kind of continuous reality, which of course is exactly what he doesn't believe in. But what makes the dreamlike touches, the surrealist touches work is that they are presented in this context of absolute concrete authenticity. Then that's something he learns during his time in Mexico.
Well, that reminds me because I was reading a little bit of writing you've done about Buñuel's films at the Chicago Reader, and I think you had a line there about Simon of the Desert, how much realism is required in surrealism.
It's true. And you see where, Dalí's attempts to make surrealist films are just miserable failures because they're pre-stylized. Yeah, you can't do that. You have to, the spectator has to discover the strangeness for themselves.
Well, let's talk about a few of the films individually. It's sort of interesting, the first and the second film. I mean, the kind of difference there, if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, the first feature, which is called Gran Casino, stars like two of the biggest stars in Mexico at that point, the most famous male singer, and Libertad Lamarque, who was a Argentinian tango singer who had come to Mexico and become a star. So this was like a stare at Roger, two superstars of the genre. And the film is it's fun and playful and not too deep. Surrealistic touches almost limited to Jorge Negrete, who's the male lead, has this little trio that always follows him around. And every time he's about to burst into song, these three guys kind of pop up in the background. And it's very funny and very subversive, pointing directly to that somewhat ridiculous artifice here. But for some reason, the film is a total failure, big commercial flop. He is able to convince Danzigate to make basically a film for export, which will be Los Olvidados. And this encounters a lot of resistance in the Mexican film industry because it's portraying, poverty in Mexico City in very harsh terms. And this wasn't something the politicians were able to see. The studios, which were very sophisticated, that they were making entertainment. But obviously, the film was made, entered the Cannes Film Festival, where it won major prize. And that kind of reminded people that Buñuel was out there, having been forgotten for a good 10 years. So at that point, he's able to lead this kind of interesting dual career. Some films he's made clearly for the international festival circuit, and other films are clearly for domestic consumption, but it doesn't divide into impersonal and personal. He invests a lot in the local films, much more than I think people realize. He's co-author on almost all of them. And when you get to know better the personalities involved in Mexican filmmaking, you can really see his appreciation for someone like Autor de Cordoba in Elle. He's the Mexican Cary Grant. He's this image of such sophistication and charm and elegance. And to cast that guy in that role, is really provocative. And it shocked a lot of people. It is able to keep moving like that through the major stars of the period.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Elle. It's one of my favorites I'd seen before, and I mean it's sort of genuinely shocking the depths of his paranoia. And it's interesting because I guess it's in his memoir. He says something like it's basically a portrait of paranoia, nothing more, nothing less. But I kind of have thought of it. I mean, you don't always have to go by what the director says. I thought that, it was actually like interesting, showing what happens if like machismo is like taken to like this sort of extremity and jealousy in that way, and what that looks like, and just sort of showing how maybe there's actually like a pathological element to it, just kind of turning it into this caricature a bit, and maybe not even a caricature either.
Yeah. I mean, the beauty about Buñuel to me is his compassion. And as ridiculous and horrible and abusive a character as L is, I mean, Buñuel, he kind of understands him. He kind of sympathizes with him. Whatever is going on in that head, which we're never given complete access to.
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, it is interesting that kind of back and forth between like a fascination and repulsion with what he's showing sometimes. And that's part of what is kind of interesting for me about Los Olvidados as well, because obviously Haibo is, obviously not a great guy, but it's clear there's a certain amount of fascination that Buñuel has with him. And he, like, for a moment, there's like a romantic fascination that like the mother of one of the other boys has for him as well. So he's not just this like out and out villain.
Oh,
He's
no.
finding that there's a charisma in this cruel character.
Yeah, I think one of the keys to Buñuel is this idea that anybody can love the deserving poor, but we need to love the undeserving poor, the poor that don't love us back, that don't appreciate what wonderful compassion and charity we're showing. And that's the real test of a Christian, a humanist. And most of us just fail that miserably, but he keeps coming back. You know, in Viridiana, particularly strong, we have the Last Supper enacted by this group of beggars who are pretty repellent. I mean, these people are not nice. You wouldn't want to hang out with them so much, but he's asking you to see them in this other light, and these are the true followers of Christ in a way that, you know, of course, makes me think of all the evangelicals right now, the hypocrisy that's going on the border. We're Christians, but we're going to put children in cages, you know, and that
Right.
Bunuel would just, he would go to town with that.
Right.
Just the most absurd, horrible thing you could think. And it's real. We're living right through that.
No, it's true. And I mean, also in Los Olvidados, I like how he shows the kids, because they're still really kids. They're like in the process of becoming people. So they're also like neither these noble children or these, you know, little brats. Like I think Peter, I think, is the young mother's son in that. You know, I mean, he's good and bad. I mean, he commits crimes, but he's also trying to like please his mother, get back in good grace with his mother.
Yeah, he's still a little kid.
Yeah. And he's also not like this charity case that he's going to rehabilitate by the end of the movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody sees the light ever. You know,
Yeah.
it's
No, you have,
no redemption.
yeah, you have that idealistic farm school principal or whatever it's called at the end there. But this is something that probably is true, right? In his memoir, I think he says that Shoeshine, that he really loved Shoeshine, the Vittorio De Sica movie, and that was part of what drew him to making something like Los Olvidados. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was sort of that neorealist moment. That style was sweeping, I mean, everywhere in the late 40s. And he probably saw, yeah, an opportunity to do something similar out in Mexico. But of course, it's a little more disturbing than Shoeshine.
Yeah.
It's not a sentimental film at all.
There's also like a sequence I completely forgot that maybe has a bit of surrealism in it when Peter the kid is at the farm school and he's trying to steal eggs and he throws one right at the camera
Yeah.
and it splatters on glass.
Yeah, these completely disruptive moments like that.
Yeah.
I don't really know how he was getting away with that stuff. There's Abismos de Pasión, which is his version of Wuthering Heights, and one of the real discoveries of this program, I think. You know, there's a scene where the couple is passionately embracing and he cuts away shots of what seems to be like a slaughterhouse or a butcher shop of these cuts of beef kind of slamming into each other. And it's like, whoa.
Wow.
This is really extreme.
Yeah.
And there it is, you know, just right in the middle of a Mexican commercial melodrama.
Yeah. That is really crazy. Well, just if we could talk about like one movie that I saw on a screening, and I just want to mention that because I've been to like, I guess, three of the screenings so far, and people are really engaged with them. Like, it's
Wow.
funny watching the movies work on like the different levels. Like, I feel like people seeing Buñuelisms in them, but also they're commercially like fun movies. Some, you know, they're just, you can sort of switch your brain off. And I think El Gran Caballero maybe fits the bill there. I mean, it's a well-honed comic machine, what he sets in motion there, I thought.
Yeah, that was based on a film he was an AD on back in Spain, which is where that came from. A Vehicle for a Popular Comedian. Yeah, he could see where that would work with Soler, who was also very, very popular Mexican stars in several of his films.
But the funny thing there is, I mean, he sort of dismisses it as this is a very commercial thing. It was really popular. But on the other hand, there is a sort of social satire in it that doesn't seem so far from what he might do. I mean,
Yeah, I don't think he's capable of making it impersonal. Even something like A Woman Without Sin, which looks like a real cheapie, like probably shot in 10 or 12 days. And he still brings his values up in that.
Yeah. And it seems like he's also working, I guess, on a number of these films. You know, as you mentioned, the studio has top-notch craftsmen, including Gabriel Figueroa, this great cinematographer. I mean, even in Los Olvidados, like these scenes that could be throwaway conversations at night, he's finding ways that there's one amazing scene where there's like this deep staging of like a conversation just in silhouette that you see using this like street lamp, just as a light in the background. He knew how to use these great tools that he had available.
Oh yeah, and it's interesting to how he sits on Figueroa sometimes. He doesn't want that spectacular pictorialism he's so capable of. And he reins him in ways that the other directors did not.
There's one movie that I didn't catch that I wonder if you could tell me about, because it sounds really amazing and I haven't seen it and I'm waiting for the screening. Death in the Garden.
Yeah. In like the mid-50s, he makes the three movies about Europeans contending with Central America. And they're all, you know, pretty bitter. this is one of those, kind of evoking a little bit Wages of Fear, which had been a tremendous success.
Yeah, the description talks about it being, you know, skeptical of like imperialist endeavors, and also this interesting way that you know, it's supposed to look like this adventure, epic adventure, but at the same time, again, there's something kind of weird under the surface going on there.
Oh yeah, he's perfectly aware of what all these Europeans are doing in Central America. At one point, some Perry says the other, well, I don't think you're going to convince these Indians to work for you. And that's exactly what they're there for.
Yeah.
Somebody to exploit.
Yeah. Maybe this is a good moment just to mention, because that's a movie, I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw that movie screened in New York. If you could talk a bit about the prints and restorations that are part of the series.
Oh, yeah. Impossible to do this without the cooperation of the two major Mexican archives. Filmoteca de la UNAM, which is a cinematheque at the Mexico's Autonomous National University. And there's a Cineteca Nacional, which is kind of the federal government. And our good friends there at the Morelia Film Festival have just been incredibly helpful. This is the fifth or sixth program I've done with them. And it just cutting through the red tape and negotiating with the various rights holders in Mexico, which is difficult. It's not always clear who owns what, which is why one film not able to show. You couldn't track down who actually owns it.
Oh, wow.
Although the film exists, but it's just not clear who we have to pay to show it. There are often unpleasant consequences if you don't pay people. They're
right.
Doing movies.
Just curious, which one is that title?
Cela s'appelle l'aurore. That is called The Dawn, which is one of the French co-productions in color, Jean Marais. You know, again, very ironic about colonialism in the 1950s. Well worth seeing, but yeah, you can find it on the web if you poke around.
Okay.
But it didn't feel quite safe in showing that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the problem before is that these films just weren't available. We've got, I think it's about half 35 and half new DCPs. And the last time somebody tried this series, I think 10 of the 21, and it was mostly 60 millimeter. So at this point, we're taking advantage of the great work that the Mexican archives have done and taking advantage of the great organizational abilities of our friends in Morelia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of a unique opportunity to see these works. I mean, I know in the past, I would have seen these on like terrible VHS or something that from the library, you know, not even something I could have rented.
Right, yeah.
And is Nazarene one of the restorations, I think?
That's a new DCP from the negative. We showed that during COVID and basically nobody showed up. Almost literally like four people.
Okay.
And this is such a good movie. It's been unavailable for a really long time. I hope people get out to see it. It's an absolute masterpiece.
That was one I went to see. And it's one that really just keeps you on your toes because it's like you keep waiting for it to break somehow or break in some way, one way or another. And I begin to wonder because I've read descriptions of it that are like, oh, it's this kind of cynical story about a priest. And by the time I got to the end of the movie, I thought, like, is this cynicism or is this actually just like realism?
I think, yeah, again, it's when you have the true Christian attitude out in the real world, it encounters difficulty. There's a certain amount of resistance out there.
And that's also kind of a big star playing the priest Francisco Rabal.
Right. Yeah, he's a Spanish actor. You know the story about the French connection. Friedkin told his casting agent to get the guy from the Buñuel film. And he was referring to Fernando Rey. The casting director thought it was part of Francisco Rabal. So when Friedkin went to the airport to pick up Francisco Rabal, Fernando Rey got off the plane. He said, who the hell is this guy? Apparently a true story.
That's great.
And then Francisco Rabal is in Sorcerer.
Oh, right. That's really funny. And Nazarene is set in, I think, like it's actually set in the past, in relation to?
Yes, yeah, somewhat indistinct. There's a really good documentary we showed a couple of years ago, Following Nazareth.
Ah.
And it's based on the really detailed location photo Buñuel took when he was scouting his location. And the film goes scene by scene and compares the shot in the movie to Buñuel's original photography to what it looks like today. A really interesting movie.
Wow.
Director named Javier Espada, who's going to be here with his second film about Buñuel. Very good movie called Buñuel, a Surrealist Filmmaker. It gets into his life in Spain, his youth, places where he lived in Mexico City. Yeah, really, really good film. Probably recommend that.
I wonder if you could say anything about him being a Spaniard in Mexico and living there.
Oh, I think he genuinely loved it there.
Yeah.
He took to it right away. And of course, he continued to live there, even while he was making his films in France. He He lived in Mexico City. He would write his films in Mexico and basically go to Europe to film them. But he remained a Mexican his whole life. And you know, the weird story is his ashes are in the podium of a Catholic church in Mexico City.
Really?
Yeah. One of his friends was a bishop in the Catholic Church, and as kind of a perverse favor, he decided they would, you know, bury Luis in the church. And as far as I know, it's the ashes are still there.
That's crazy.
So he's a permanent churchgoer
Well, that reminds me
now.
the I guess at the end of his memoir, he tells that story where he's like, I always wanted to play a practical joke on my where on my deathbed, I'd bring all my atheist friends and then I'd take confession in front of them.
Yeah, he's the man who lived for paradox. I mean, it's such a gift, you know, to do that.
Well, maybe we can wrap up a bit with any other films in the series. If there's one or other two you want to make sure that we highlight. I mean, I know for me, I really love Criminal Life of Archibaldo de la Cruz.
I think Illusion Travels by Streetcar is really a nice surprise. It's a folk comedy, very affectionate. It's, you know, probably the only Buñuel film I would describe as warm-hearted. And it really is. It's totally delightful, just full of surprises. It's a flat-out comedy. Not what you expect from him, but a nice little film. Going to take a chance on something that you don't know. That's what I mean.
Great. Yeah, I definitely hope that people come and see these. Definitely been seeing a lot of people there. I'm really happy that this series is happening. Thanks, Dave, for coming and talking about Buñuel.
My pleasure.
The annual series at the Museum of Modern Art to save and project. It has its 20th edition this year, so it's a 20th anniversary. So I thought it would be a great time to talk about a lot of the films there. It's been a series that I've been going to, I don't know, for a while. I might have even gone to the first one. Who better to talk about it than curator at the Department of Film at MoMA, Josh Siegel?
Hi there, how are you?
I guess this is the first time that you're on the podcast, so you'll have to put up with all my whims.
No, I'm bracing myself.
Which are pretty much non-existent. You know, as usual, I think part of the challenge about writing about or podcasting about the series is that if you're really trying, as you do, to draw on many different cinemas, many different traditions, it's impossible to get the scope of the series. So, I mean, that must be kind of an annual challenge, just, you know, putting together the mosaic for each year.
Well, I mean, I have a sort of a maximalist approach, let's say, to this festival, which is to say that I have this tendency to fill every single slot we can possibly fill and still feel rueful of all the films that we're not able to include. You know, I started this festival 20 years ago selfishly because I thought, you know, here are all these movies that are being restored around the world that I haven't gotten a chance to see, so maybe I'll just figure out a way of bringing them to New York. And then surely there's at least a few people who might want to accompany me to see them in the theater. That really was the impetus. And I really try to be very Catholic in my tastes, I mean, as eclectic as possible. And then the fun thing that happens is that you start seeing through lines, you start seeing common themes emerge that you may not have foreseen when you put it together. There are some inspired double bills or, you know, connections that I make in advance, but then there are others that just you can't possibly have anticipated.
Well, I mean, I guess one of the planned double bills, or I assume as much as having the Warhol film, Bitch, with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Absolutely.
But I'm curious, what's something that struck you only as it was coming together?
Well, I was struck that, you know, there's a kind of hoary story of the kind of dupe or milquetoast who kind of falls for the woman on the other side, the dark side, and is kind of drawn into a life of the illicit, the criminal, the tawdry, the venal, and you know, that of course is a time-worn theme of many films, especially melodramas. But I did find it interesting that you see this across different cultures as well as periods of this festival. So you have a film like John Ford's Aerosmith, in which, you know, Colman understandably leaves Helen Hayes for Myrna Loy in some rainforest of some unnamed West Indian colony, because who wouldn't? It's an obvious choice. Or you have the retelling of Carmen in the form of The Wild, Wild Rose, which is a wonderful 1960 Hong Kong quasi-musical melodrama starring Grace Wang, or you have Anne Mae Wong in Pavement Butterfly. And so, the ways in which you have either underappreciated actors like Grace or Wong, or unseen films in their original versions like John Ford's Arrowsmith. And you have these incredible filmmakers and actors who are reinterpreting what I described as a kind of hoary or cliche trope of melodrama in their own way. And I find it sort of exciting to see them and see those themes and kind of conceits and different approaches emerge.
Yeah, that's something that comes out when you attend a number of the screenings too, I think. I was hoping to talk about one film in particular, which I gather is getting basically a week-long run, or I'm not sure because I was assuming that from there being a review of it. But that's Bushman,
Yes.
directed by David Shikley, who is the brother of the songmeister, parodist.
PDQ Bach, who very oddly died the day after we had the premiere of Bushman in New York.
Oh, no kidding.
In fact, he was supposed to attend the screening and didn't, and now we know why. But David Shikley, who is someone who I had never heard of, I mean, Bushman was the great revelation for me in Bologna, where there's a festival that I essentially stole to create To Save and Project. There's a festival of restorations that's been going on for 40, upwards of 40 years, Ritrovato. And Bushman for me was one of the great epiphanies. It's one of these films that, where has it been all my life? But in some sense, it's been hiding in plain sight. But it's a film from 1971 that, in profound and kind of subtle ways, deals with questions of race and colonialism and the experience of exile in the form of a white filmmaker creating a kind of hybrid fictional documentary, somewhat in the vein of Portrait of Jason, or there are a number of other filmmakers that one could mention, but of a Nigerian emigre who has escaped the civil war taking place back at home. And it's both barbed and funny and three-dimensional in its portrait. This is a time, 71, when you're dealing with race, when all too often films tend to kind of fall back on cliches or kind of one-dimensional portraits of race problems or portraits of blacks, whether in America or abroad in Africa. And this is, one of those films that is quite the opposite. It's incredibly subtle and very powerful because the protagonist, Gabriel, is such a full rounded figure.
Yeah, I was pretty stunned by it. As you said, it kind of brings together, it's sort of a stronger version of a number of different types of films that were coming out at the time or at different tendencies. I mean, he's Nigerian, I guess name he uses in the United States is Paul. And I just love how Shikley alternates between him having these, I don't know, just kind of misadventures with a woman, with women, and then his two camera, just kind of being a raconteur, basically.
Yeah.
About his life, and he's really entertaining, and has all these funny, almost these satirical summaries of life as he's living it, there and also back home. He's kind of interesting, like in between position, it seems, where he's a commentator for both being in Nigeria but also being in the States. Also, I thought the cinematography was incredible.
Beautiful, right? Beautiful. Well, it's such beautiful black and white cinematography.
Who shot that? I mean, I looked it up.
Now, I've been remiss. I've been meaning to look more into him. He's somebody I'd never heard of. I've been so swept up in this festival and hosting people because, as you said, it's the cinematography is a revelation.
Yeah, just to put a name to it, and I know there are other people probably involved in making it, but I guess it's David Myers. And then if you look at some of the stuff he shot, it's pretty eclectic and pretty interesting. But I think, you get these vantage points, whether they're like exteriors or in this empty bar where he visits at one point with, which, I mean, are just even unusual, like camera placements that give you these new vantage points, and they kind of really lift it to another level. Because I think here you have this interesting combination of, again, this kind of like documentary, like to camera, and then these just gorgeous, setups, all
You
around.
know, it's funny because there is a film that recalled for me, it's obviously, of course, tricky, especially in that period, to have a white filmmaker turn a camera on a black subject. But I was put in mind of this incredible film, Hunger, by Henning Carlson, that was shot by Sven Nykvist
Oh, yeah.
in South Africa under apartheid. And as you can imagine, with Sven Nykvist as your cinematographer, the photography is extraordinary. And they went there under the pretense of making a commercial, a Danish commercial. And of course, nothing's further from the truth. They were making a portrait of, the incarceral life of Black South Africans. And you are struck. You cannot help but be struck by the cinematography. And there's an ennobling quality to it, even as it carries a kind of energy and a charisma, but that's, as you said, born of the character of Paul and his performance. It's also the idea that you're not giving short shrift to the production quality of the film that you're in, which you're making these portraits, that you've dedicated as much care and love to the aesthetic quality of the film as you are to the content of the film. And I think that's a meaningful statement, right? You find that also, I mean, just parenthetically, we devoted a evening to Skip Norman's films, who was a, among other things, a cinematographer, as well as being a writer and director and visual anthropologist. But he worked with Helge Sander and Haroun Faruqi and others in 1970s Germany, and then back here in the 80s with people like Mira Bank. But again, you have somebody who really cares about the craft of filmmaking as much as about putting forward the experience of Black Panthers, for example, or the experience of being a Black exile in West Germany in the 60s and 70s.
Absolutely. No, and I'm glad you mentioned that because I did watch a couple of the shorts. I watched Blues People, which is strong stuff as well. Just pulls no punches. And just to kind of finish with Bushman, I have to mention the rupture that he finds a way to include in the movie, which is that Paul was, I guess, actually deported, and accused of, I guess, bombing, like being a bomber. And they incorporate that in a movie, incorporate that absence, that rupture in the movie in a way that I guess it sort of would be good to let people discover. But it's, I thought that was also, it takes it to another level on top of everything. So yeah, that was amazing to me as well. Maybe just to switch to an entirely different film, Undercurrent, which I'm sort of singling out because it might not jump out the same way some of the other selections would, but I thought was just a pretty stirring and gorgeously shot melodrama from Japan from the 50s. And I'm curious how that made its way into the selection. Also, the ending, I don't want to give away, but it's also just like really just hard hitting.
I mean, it's another example, of course, of that approach to melodrama, right? That, obviously Kazuburo Yoshimura has seen Douglas Sirk melodramas, but he makes it something entirely his own. But the reason I showed it is twofold. One is that his use of color is extraordinary, and it's hard to resist showing a film on a big screen from 1950s Japan with such beautiful color, especially one that deals with such, the theme, of course, of kimono and neckties and design and patterning and layering. And of course, the compositions are both Western and Japanese. It's kind of a tension between the two. But really, the reason I did it is also because I did a big retrospective of Kazuo Miyagawa, the cinematographer, about 5 years ago. And for me, he's one of the great unsung, not only cinematographers of the world, but really one of the guys who contributed to the look of so many important films, including Rashomon or The Rickshaw Man. And he was as good in color as he was with black and white. Not every cinematographer that's true of, but he was. And I think that this is a pretty good testament to that.
I mean, it would be worth preserving if only for the sequence where they're sharing drinks at this inn that they stop at, where, I mean, it's like time stands still for a second. They have to turn off the light. That's the narrative reason because there's a moth there or something like that. And then he just shoots it in, I don't even know how to characterize it. It's like, it's not amber, it's some amazing color. So it's basically monochrome in that color and just things edged in shadow in the most beautiful way. I mean, it honestly could be something out of like In the Mood for Love, between the protagonist and the professor that she's seeing, and that's kind of like their climactic meeting. That's just amazing. So yeah, I'm glad we could mention Undercurrent.
These are films that I'm sure they'll, some of them, I hope, something like Undercurrent will find its way onto Criterion Channel. So I think you'll have a chance to see some of these. Bushman, as you mentioned, is having a run. So I think that some of these have afterlives. One of the impetus is to get people to look at these films and decide to pick them up for distribution. That's one of the reasons we do this festival. So if there are other people out there who've seen it and are delighted by it, maybe they'll be inspired to give it a theatrical run.
Yeah, and just to give the bare outlines of the plot is that it's about a woman, it's sort of an independent, professional woman plot, I guess, that you would see occasionally, where she's just having to stave off all these different men, making her own choice in that regard, and also just professionally. And there's this interesting thing of moving between different eras because she works at this kind of old-fashioned dying, her father's a dyer. So it's this interesting combination of tradition and moving forward.
Well, the theme of working women is obviously another one that runs through this whole festival, and that, again, it wasn't necessarily intentional. In some cases, it was like Franza Wood's wonderful shorts about working women, a woman who works as a cleaner in a Pilates studio, or even Petrine Deneuve's character in Agnès Varda's The Creatures, in some sense, perhaps a stand-in for Varda herself. Or when a film Cutter Blunders, which is a wonderful portrait of the Weimar era new woman from 1924 Germany, or even the wonderful films we showed, actually, come to think of it, about housewives and the burdens of housewifery that Rick Prelinger showed in these wonderful industrials. And talk about dazzling color, they're mind-blowing. How you turn a aging kitchen into something that's functional for, this beleaguered housewife. But these are actually interesting performances by women across the board. I think that that's something important to highlight too.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe I can squeeze in another couple of films. One, just because, also there's a lot of attention on her. I mean, there should be and always often is on Chantal Ackerman. So you have a restoration of Toute une nuit, which is often been hard to see. I know the first time I saw it was on some sort of godforsaken VHS.
Yeah, I can't imagine most people have seen this in preserved form.
So I wonder if you could say a bit about this film, also because I'm so glad that this progression has gone from like it being hard to see some of her movies to her having made the greatest movie of all time, which,
Yeah.
but it's still sort of her 80s films, I think, haven't received the attention that they deserve because she's doing new experiments there, I think. So I wonder if you could talk about Toute une nuit a bit.
I completely agree. I mean, I think in some ways she's trying to play with Hollywood genre and trying to be playful. And I think these two films that we showed as a kind of, there was a companion piece she made with students from a film school she was helping to teach at Hotel des Acacias, the education hotel, the same year in 1982 as she did Toute une nuit, are both films that really kind of are lead ups to her musical comedy Golden 80s made that same year. So obviously this is stuff that she's thinking about at the time, about how you can kind of, in a sense, deconstruct the idea of a one night stand, or compress in a single evening, or even in a single scene, a single encounter, the whole of a relationship, the whole of a love, of an experience of love, so that the form of the film is the traces, in a sense, the arc of love, using professional and non-professional actors, some of whom were just her friends. And the repetition of the film, which is something obviously very important to all of Chantal's work, but the repetition of the film is something that becomes almost kind of hypnotic, and it calls attention. It's perhaps maybe in a way a meta commentary on what she thought of as her film about Madame Bovary. I mean, a lot of her films are literary. I mean, she adapted everyone from Proust to Melville, but I think that in this case, what can you distill of Madame Bovary that is universal and that is something that traffics in cliche in an interesting way?
Yeah. A couple things I also want to ask about on this film. I mean, one is just an observation, which there's also sort of a droll comedic quality to it that comes up. I mean, I found a lot of this movie, I still do, pretty funny.
It is. It's absolutely funny. I mean, it's of course it's campy. It's also making allusion, I think, to Fassbender.
Yeah, that's true. And the other thing, though, obviously she was really into Pina Bausch and made a film about her. And I feel like I see something dance-like and I in this and in other films of hers in the 80s especially. And I'm wondering, if you can illuminate what that influence or what that kind of cross-pollinization might have been.
I mean, I can't speak factually to her relationship with Pina Bausch, but I think you're spot on in the sense that this is a choreographed film and that every single movement of every one of the actors is something. I mean, it's as much Pina Bausch as it is Vincent Minnelli, Michael Kidd, or musical numbers of or Jerome Robbins. I mean, I agree that there's something kind of stripped down, and that gives it the Peanut Bausch aspect. But there is something I think also very much about Hollywood musicals of the 50s, you know, not in the overt, expressionistic, extroverted way of a Jacques Demy film, but in an introverted, cerebral, yet sensuous, but I think very distilled way in a film like Toute une Nuit. And I think, you know, it also recalls Yvonne Rainer's work, which is also, of course, dance-related filmmaking that also is trying to reinvent the melodrama. And I think there's a lot of comedic aspects in Yvonne's films as much as there are in Chantal's. But absolutely, I mean, dance is essential to these films of this period.
And just also, as ever, being like this poet of, I mean, duration in an abstract sense, but more a poet here of waiting, basically,
Yeah.
in this beautiful, beautiful way. Well, let's maybe, if we could wrap up with a change of pace, just a quick word for a collection of shorts that was shown this year, I guess, sort of related to Devo having a documentary. I've seen some of them, I think, in the past, but watching the documentary, it's really interesting thinking of them going from avant-garde to popular.
I mean, first of all, it was an incredibly fun, funny, for me, nostalgic evening having Jerry Casale and Mark Mothersbaugh together with Peter Kanheim, who was a rock musician, among other things, but who also was responsible for these restorations. Having them on stage, you know, first of all, there's nothing that they've forgotten. They remember every minutiae of every concert and every music video they ever made. It's kind of astonishing that after 50 years, they know all this stuff still. But what you don't realize, I mean, until you watch these, is that they had stockpiled about eight or nine of them before MTV even came around. And if anything, MTV was kind of horrified by showing some of these things because they were so kind of polymorphous, perverse, also kind of in a way politically incendiary. I mean, they really were. There's a really kind of angry political streak that is obviously, sadly, as relevant now as it was when they were making these. I mean, if anything, more so about the collapse of democracy, among other things. And it's also an opportunity for them to delve into their archives and find these little gems that nobody realized remembered existed, like this scene we showed from Max's Kansas City. I think it was their third New York concert, and David Bowie introduces them. And the only reason they were saying that anyone was there in Max's Kansas City to watch it is because Bowie had heard that these guys were good and that he dragged all his friends to come.
Wow.
And it ends up this kind of proto-punk, free, new wave, both comically aggressive and aggressively aggressive concert that you're kind of amazed. I mean, these guys were really ahead of their time. And then in terms of just the craft of music video making, it does make you realize how many knockoffs came out after them. You know, it's not for nothing that they collaborated with Bruce Conner. These guys knew art and they knew cinema and they knew design. And, you know, in a way, even before Talking Heads and David Byrne, they were doing some of the similar work and collaborating with, you know, real, and Brian Eno even. I mean, collaborating with both real musicians and real music producers, but also real graphic designers and real artists and filmmakers.
I also, it's very nostalgic for me to think about them and talk about them and to think what, I mean, speaking of having being in plain sight, thinking of even just in the music videos that did get shown, what they were putting out there and on that scale is pretty incredible. It kind of imploding consumerism from the inside.
Yeah.
What is it? Going Under, I think, was a soundtrack for a Miami Vice episode.
I don't even remember that. That's funny.
So yeah, we've gone from David Shikley's Bushmen to Undercurrent, Japanese studio system to Devo. So the whole gamut, and we're still leaving out a lot.
And we're still leaving out a lot, but that's the nature of this festival.
Yeah. And just to conclude, I also just want to give a shout out for the Iranian series from the last fall.
Oh, I really appreciate that. That was quite an undertaking. You know, we're hoping to do more on the subject in the future.
Oh, great.
And in fact, I did a follow-up in a way to one of the films that we showed in that series, Kalpush, by one of the pioneers of Armenian cinema, Hamo Bek Nazarian, in showing in the Preservation Festival, The House on the Volcano and Land of Nayeri, Soviet-era Armenian films in the Dzhigaverta vein, but they're quite amazing. I mean, just a piece of filmmaking, but also in light of the conflict going on in Nagorno-Karabakh now between Azerbaijan and Armenia, the idea that he helped to create the Azerbaijani film industry as much as he did the Armenian film industry is kind of astonishing.
That's incredible. All right. Well, we'll bring things to a conclusion there. But thanks, Josh, for talking about the 20th edition.
Thank you so much for your interest. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapol. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapol.substack.com. Thank you for listening.